Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, I'll speak with Dr. Joseph Keenan from the University of Minnesota about changes in the country's food industry and how they might affect heart health. First, after Bruce Lunsford's unsuccessful attempt to unseat Republican U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell last November, Kentucky Democrats began focusing on how they could win the Commonwealth's other Senate seat, held by the GOP's Jim Bunning. Bunning narrowly defeated Dan Mongiardo in 2004, and he's up for re-election next year. As Gabe Bullard reports, this time around, questions about Bunning's political future are being raised within his own party.
Jim Bunning says he will seek a third term next year.
I'm going to run.
Bunning conducted a poll in February to gauge support for his re-election bid, but the sometimes irascible 77-year-old senator declined recently to disclose the results.
Let's say that I did the polling.
What does that mean?
That means it's none of your goddamn business.
Those comments are from conference calls with reporters in February and March. Bunning later apologized for the profanity. Speculation over Bunning's political future intensified at the beginning of the year, when he reported having relatively little campaign cash on hand. He said that's because he delayed fundraising to help GOP candidates in the 2008 elections. Meanwhile, Senator Mitch McConnell told the National Press Club in January he wasn't sure if his Kentucky counterpart would seek a third term, prompting this response from Bunning in another conference call.
He had a lapse of memory or something when he was speaking to the press club last week when he said that he didn't know what my intentions were. He knew very well what my intentions were.
When they treat Bunning's candidacy as a possibility and he's treating it as a reality, then it's clear that they don't want him to run.
Al Cross is a longtime political writer and the head of the Institute for Rural Journalism at the University of Kentucky.
I think that they have looked at his propensity to commit gaffes, his narrow reelection last time in a year when George Bush was carrying the state by 15 points, and his lack of fundraising up to this point, and probably some poll numbers, and concluded that he is going to have a hard time holding the seat for the Republican Party, which desperately needs every seat it can get in the U.S. Senate.
Two Republicans say they're ready to jump into the race only if Bunning decides to retire. One of them is Secretary of State Trey Grayson.
Jim Bunning is a friend and a mentor. He is running for re-election, and as long as he's running for re-election, I don't have any plans to run against him in a primary.
And then there's Bowling Green Dr. Rand Paul, who's the son of former presidential candidate Ron Paul.
My goal is to tell everybody within earshot I will run if Senator Bunning won't, and that I want to represent the conservative wing of the party, and I don't think the conservative wing of the party is being adequately represented.
Paul and Grayson both say they're close to Bunning politically, especially when it comes to economic policy, which they call a key to victory in 2010. Neither has officially begun raising money or campaigning, but Paul says he'll use the same grassroots efforts that powered his father's presidential bid, while Grayson says he can rely on his reputation as a Republican up-and-comer.
Everywhere I go, people ask me what I'm going to run for next, and they encourage me to look at other offices because they know that I'm term limited as Secretary of State in 2011.
Well, the person who's not going to wait on Bunning is David Williams.
That's Al Cross again. He's talking about Kentucky Senate President David Williams, who's expressed interest in the seat.
I expect Williams will be in the race next month after Bunning reports a poor fundraising performance in the first quarter.
Williams hasn't officially declared his candidacy, and calls to his office on the matter weren't returned. Williams met last month with officials from the National Republican Senatorial Committee, prompting Bunning to say he would sue the NRSC if it recruited an opponent to run against him. The committee's chairman, Senator John Cornyn of Texas, says it supports Bunning. Cornyn told the Courier-Journal the meeting with Williams was just a courtesy visit. As Kentucky Democrats watch it all unfold, they're positioning for their own primary. Lieutenant Governor Dan Mongiardo has formally announced he'll run again. Attorney General Jack Conway has said he's considering the race, as is Congressman Ben Chandler. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
March is National Nutrition Month, and health officials say one of the many benefits of a smart diet is prevention of heart disease. Dr. Joseph Keenan is professor of family medicine at the University of Minnesota and a nationally recognized expert on cardiovascular disease and nutritional research. I spoke to him about nutrition and heart health, the effect of stress on the heart, and some new developments in the food industry aimed at reducing the risk of heart disease. The first couple of months of the year are the highest reported for heart attacks. Why is that?
Well, that's interesting, and it's been reproducible year after year. It appears that it's a combination of factors. Probably the holiday stress is a big contributor. Not only does it raise stress hormones when you're under a lot of time pressure, financial pressure, relationships sometimes get strained then, but also we seem to get off our good behavior then. We eat a little bit more than usual, perhaps don't have time to do our exercise. And one other factor, when you're under a lot of stress, your immune resistance goes down. And we know now that frequent colds or infections that are also occur this time of year can raise your risk for heart disease.
And on top of all that, we have the economy that's causing a lot of people a lot of stress.
Wow, you know, this is where we may see this year that heart attack risk spreading out throughout the year. I think we've got an epidemic of stress, and we know that stress does a lot of bad things to your body and to your resistance to heart disease. Among them, it raises blood pressure, which is hard on the heart. It increases your risk for getting diabetes, which is an independent risk factor for heart disease. And the stress hormones, when they're present in your body, let's say you do have the misfortune of having a heart attack, those stress hormones tend to cause the heart rhythm to be unstable and cause sudden death. In fact, you know, the 30% of people who don't get to the hospital with their first heart attack, who die suddenly, those are mainly due to the stress hormones that are in their body at the time of that heart attack.
We'll change the subject a little bit. Now you are advocating what are called, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, Coralwise plant sterols. What is that?
Yes. Well, plant sterols are kind of the new and exciting thing in the area of nutrition and heart disease prevention. Plant sterols are present in all of the foods that we eat that come from plant sources, you know, so vegetables, fruits, grains, and so on. Plant sterols, what we've seen, we know, will actively lower your cholesterol. Now, even if you're a full-on vegetarian, you know, eat plants entirely for your meals, there's not enough plant sterols to do a great deal of cholesterol lowering. But what we've found now, food scientists have been able to fortify some of our everyday foods by adding extra plant sterols. They extract plant sterols, for instance, from soybeans, and then add them back into orange juice, to milk, to bread, muffins, to granola bars, cheese even. And there's even a plant sterol pill, a vitamin, Centrum Cardiovitamin, that's fortified with plant sterols. Now, the exciting thing about this is they almost have the effect of some of our drugs that we use for cholesterol. The plant sterols, two servings of any of these fortified foods in any given day, can actively lower your cholesterol, the bad cholesterol that is, by up to 15%. Now that translates into reduction in your risk for a heart attack of about 30%. And as I say, that's getting very close to the benefit we see from many of our cardiac drugs.
Now, do products that contain this material, are they more expensive?
No, that's the other good news. You know, Minute Maid orange juice has probably 10 varieties, but the one that's got plant sterols is the same price as the others. Same with the milk and bread. Now, I would say to your listeners, since these products vary regionally in the country, you might want to go on a website called coralwise.com. Coralwise.com, and look and see what products are available regionally where you are. And in addition, there are new products coming online all the time. But the milk is the same price. It's low-fat milk, of course, so it doesn't add risk from some other ingredients. The bread is high fiber. You know, that's really easy to get plant sterols into a meal, you know, a glass of milk in the morning, a couple of pieces of bread at a meal, and you've got your risk reduced considerably.
Now, is there one particular company that's leading the charge on this?
Well, the company that's sort of that produces the plant sterols is Cargill Company, and they of course are a wholesaler, but they sell the plant sterols for various retail companies to add to their products. And so you've got you know, Kroger and I guess you'd say the Oro-Wise bread company is probably the biggest bread company. Minute Maid certainly is the biggest in the area of juice, and Centrum for vitamin supplements. And then there are quite a few smaller companies that make products that are primarily available regionally.
So just for the sake of disclosure, the company has brought you on board to talk about this?
Cargill is the company that sponsors my activities, yeah.
Now, I'm sure you'll recommend this is all part of a well-balanced lifestyle that includes exercise and all that sort of thing as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first thing we want to talk about is exercise. You know, that's free, and it's by far the healthiest thing you can do to reduce your risk of heart disease and actually promote a lot of other positive things in your body, good blood pressure, good weight, good cardiovascular conditioning. And we're talking now really 30 to 45 minutes of an aerobic exercise each day. That's enough to really keep your heart in quite good shape. And another good thing is it raises the HDL cholesterol, the so-called good cholesterol. HDL works in our body almost like, you might say, like Drano. It goes and cleans the pipes out from the blockage that occurs with bad cholesterol. So it's very important to be aware not only of lowering bad cholesterol, but keeping your good cholesterol up.
Any advice on how to reduce stress in our lives?
Well, you know, this is the other thing that is on everybody's mind right now, of course, with the economy and all the associated stresses. What we have to keep in mind is there are parts of our lives that we can control and some that we can't. Now, if you've lost your job, you really have a major economic problem and your finances are going to be difficult. But really, you still can do the important things for heart health, like exercise, like proper nutrition. As I mentioned, and you mentioned, these foods don't cost anymore to eat heart healthy. And the important thing is to try to maintain some part of your life each day where you do what's important for you to reduce stress. Now, for me, it's exercise. But for some people, they need quiet time. They want to be alone in a quiet way to collect their thoughts, to sort of organize themselves. Others, reading a book, listening to music, meditating, getting a massage. But you should almost like a prescription, make sure you get some of that kind of time in each day so that the stress doesn't build up and create, as I said, these bad hormone levels that are so unhealthy.
At what age should we start checking our cholesterol?
Well, that's another very interesting new finding. We used to recommend age 21 for everybody, but there's a lot of evidence now that if you have the genetics, let's say a parent or a brother, sister, uncle, aunt, who's died of heart disease or had a heart attack at an early age, that would be under the age of 50 for a man, under the age of 65 for a woman, then you really should have your children checked at age 2. That sounds like it's terribly young, but we know now that as early as early school years, young children are already building up plaque or hardening of the arteries from bad cholesterol levels. And of course, at that age, diet is very effective, especially diet and exercise, to preventing this. And, you know, we have a lot of kids now who spend a lot of time either playing video games, watching TV, not being very active, and this is increasing, you know, their risk and our population risk for heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure.
Very good. Dr. Keenan, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate
it. My pleasure.
When we come back, Daniel Gillum of Classical 90.5 previews an upcoming production of Dido and Aeneas from the University of Louisville. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. It's our spring membership drive at WFPL and Louisville Public Media. This means it might be time for you to renew your membership or consider becoming a new member of Public Radio. Everything you hear on WFPL is made possible through the support of listeners like you, especially locally produced shows like Studio 619. A pledge at any amount helps us bring you the local news and shows you deserve. Call us now and become a member. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer learns more about an upcoming play from the Looking for Lilith Theater Company. First, the University of Louisville Opera Theater program is presenting Dido and Aeneas with the Early Music Ensemble at the Henry Clay Building at the end of March. Daniel Gillum talked with university professor and stage director Michael Ramack about the production and the opera.
University opera programs can be one of two things: a vehicle to launch an individual's career, or a classroom where everyone is given an opportunity to learn. That's the mission of the University of Louisville Opera Theater. Michael Ramack is the stage director for the upcoming production of Dido and Aeneas.
We were looking for an opera that had a lot of women's roles so we could train our younger singers. And Dido and Aeneas has a lot of women's roles because it was originally written for a girls' high school boarding school in England. So most of the roles, particularly the big roles, are all women. Aeneas and the sailor, they're the only other two named roles. The sailor has one song, and Aeneas doesn't even have an aria. He just has recitatives. So it's really very heavy on the women's roles, and that was one reason. This is also a perfect training opera for them because it's not... first of all, it's in English. Second of all, it's not terrifically long. It's a little more than an hour long. And so it seemed an opportunity to sort of kill two birds with one stone.
So university opera is less about star roles and big arias and more about training opportunities for all of your students.
Right. The whole focus behind the opera theater is for us to train our students. If we do a good performance, and luckily, knock wood, we have done some pretty good performances, it's about training each individual singer. We don't want for them to consider themselves stars or divas or any of that stuff. We want them to consider themselves working singer actors. And so what we're doing is we're training them to pick up an entirely new craft besides singing. We're asking them to pick up acting. Considering how much time they spend on singing, they get a little bit of acting, enough to know where they're going and how to do it, how to build the character, enough to do bows and curtsies and period, and how to deal with costumes and all that stuff. Essentially, we're giving them an actor's toolkit, a basic toolkit that they can take out into the world and be in any kind of performance. But the focus is on always the group as a whole, not individuals.
Let's talk about the period and this particular production. It's not at U of L, it's at Henry Clay. Tell us how you came up with this idea of this ballroom opera.
Well, as you mentioned, the performances is in the Grand Ballroom in the Henry Clay Building, and it stems from last year. I stage-managed Dancing with the Stars for the orchestra benefit, and I loved that space. It's a beautiful Baroque ballroom restored with such amazing care, and when the time came, when Dido and Aeneas came up in the sort of in the mix that we were doing it, I contacted the Henry Clay and said, do you have any space available? And luckily they had a week. But it seemed to make sense to me that we do a Baroque opera in a Baroque ballroom. And it's beautiful. And it's a different venue. And also, it provides us the flexibility with many spaces to actually do a theatrical performance there. And the people at the Henry Clay have been terrific.
So how is this experience going to be different for the audience member as opposed to a standard opera at the Whitney or at Comstock?
This performance at the Henry Clay is going to be a lot different because it's going to be far more intimate. Most audience members will be no more than, well, some people will be 1 foot from the performers if you sit in the first row, but they will be sitting no more than 20 feet from all of the performers. Essentially, it'll be a semi-thrust situation with the orchestra on the right-hand side, and it will be really probably the most intimate opera experience that anyone has had in Louisville for a long time. It's should be quite interesting, and I think it will be quite invigorating to be that close to the singers. Baroque opera is a strange bird. It's I always like to liken it to the American musical before Oklahoma. Other than Showboat, we really don't know all that many. The music survives in the American musical, Rodgers and Hart, the Gershwins, Irving Berlin, but we no longer do those productions because the framework, the actual shows, were so flimsy and also so time and performer specific that we can no longer recreate them. Baroque opera was forgotten for many, many years. It was rediscovered in the late 60s. People started producing it again, but not with great regularity. The opera was predicated on most people understanding what it was about before they ever saw it. So I have added, from Virgil itself, all of the background information that you need to see the production.
The opera is interesting in that it builds to the very end, to this very last aria and chorus that a lot of people know. And you were saying how important this aria is to studying the literature itself.
When I Am Late is Dido's last aria as she's dying. And followed by With Drooping Wings, which is a chorus number. And it's in my textbook that I teach, and I teach my class that. But also, I know that most of the other professors have it in their textbook. So it's historically relevant, but also they're really beautiful.
Michael Ramach is the stage director for the upcoming production of Dido and Aeneas. The music featured here was from a compact disc of the Academy of Ancient Music Chorus and Orchestra.
Daniel Gillum spoke with Michael Ramach about the opera Dido and Aeneas by Henry Purcell. Ramach is a professor at the University of Louisville and the stage director for its upcoming production of the opera. It takes place Friday through Sunday at the Henry Clay Building. On March 25, 1911, 146 garment workers in New York City lost their lives and what has become known as the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. Some died in the fiery building, others jumped to their deaths. Most of them were immigrant women. Now the theater company Looking for Lilith is premiering the play Fabric, Flames, and Fervor, Girls of the Triangle. While the event has been the subject of books and plays before, the company wanted to take a new look at the event and the women who worked in the factory. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Shannon Woolley, the company's artistic director, and Kathy Ellis, who is directing the play.
Other plays have been written about the Triangle Fire, but why did the company decide to create a new play on the subject?
Several years ago, I read a wonderful book by David von Drehl called Triangle, The Fire That Changed America. And I was very moved by the way that he had reconstructed the story of all of the participants, the workers, the rescuers, the media, the managers. But as I read the book, I also realized that it had great dramatic potential, and I also knew that Looking for Lilith, because of the way that they construct their plays, was the company to bring the project to. And I set up a meeting with Shannon and Trina, another company member, and discovered that they too had a connection with the Triangle Fire.
When I was in graduate school at NYU, my thesis project was to devise a play about the history of Greenwich Village with the entire master's class. And the portion that I focused on was the history of the Ash Building and the Triangle Fire. And as I was doing that research as part of my graduate work, it struck me that much of the research that had been done was very clinical and factual, and not a lot of depth into the lives of who the women were or who they might have become. And so when Kathy came to Looking for Lilith with this project, that was the tact that she wanted to take, was not only the tragedy of the life that was lost, but the unsung potential of the women that had been involved.
Had you read any of the other plays, or were you familiar with them, that were about the Triangle Fire?
I was aware that there was one piece that was in development at the time that we began this project. Since then, it has been published, but we, for obvious reasons, haven't chosen to read that play because this production needed to be about our vision of the stories. And as Shannon said, telling the stories from the point of view of the girls as opposed to some of the other players.
Well, what is Looking for Lilith's take on this actual event, and how did you structure the play that's reflective of the company's, I guess, artistic aesthetic?
Well, the mission of Looking for Lilith is to re-examine events in history from the perspectives of the women that were involved and then create original performance pieces based on that examination. So while the Triangle Fire is known as the greatest workplace tragedy before September 11th, I think that what is not as known is what a galvanizing force it was for the women's labor movement, specifically for the Women's Trade Union League. And so much of our plays are based on oral history. And of course, with this project, the last survivor of the fire died in the year 2000. And so we weren't able to take oral histories. But the court transcripts, which are public record, have hours and hours of transcriptions of the immigrant women testifying about what happened on that day. And many of the women who were involved on that day also were a part of the uprising of the 20,000 in 1909, which was the great garment worker strike of the Women's Trade Union League, where 20,000 garment workers walked out of work protesting the same unsafe conditions that caused the Triangle Factory fire.
And how did you put the play together? Did you read through all the testimony in order to do this?
Shannon read through a lot of the trial transcripts and did a lot of culling before it came to the group. And then we also read contemporary newspaper stories and listened to some of the recordings of the survivors' memories that had been taken on significant anniversaries of the fire. And from all of those resources, during the devising process, we would improvise scenes. Somebody might say, oh, I feel really strongly about this aspect. Let me go away and see if I can write a scene about it. We would pull together different language from different pieces of primary sources, and those became our canvas, if you will. We had lots and lots of different pieces that we then put together.
Part of the way that I structured the devising process also was so that the devising team could sort of live in sequence the events of the girls' lives. We devised for about 5 months, mm-hmm. and we spent maybe the first 3 weeks focusing on immigrant life and what were the situations that these young women had been leaving. Why had they come to America? And then we spent a couple of weeks focusing on life in the tenements, and we would read a section of an essay or diary entry about life in the tenements and then create some scenes around that. Then we went through the strike, then to the fire, and then to the aftermath of the fire, so that we sequentially went through those experiences.
And that was really valuable in terms of the creative process. However, that's not the way we chose to tell the story, because when you do a play about the Triangle Fire, clearly there's no surprise in terms of what's going to happen. And I don't mean that to sound facile. So the fire itself became the core, the center of the piece. And then we sort of unraveled the story on both sides of the fire. So the final production that people will see is a nonlinear exploration of the piece, so that we would be able to focus on the relationships and emotional lives of the girls.
Was there anything in your research that you learned about these women that you didn't already know?
Not necessarily new, but what was really affirming was to realize just how much pride so many of them took in their work, and the fact that there were genuine friendships, that there were genuine opportunities to socialize and to have fun outside of the workplace. Even though the hours were very, very long, they work 6 days a week, there was a sense of camaraderie among so many of these women. And that is something that we've tried to bring into the show so that it isn't just about overworked girls who finally die.
The play Fabric, Flames, and Fervor, Girls of the Triangle, opens Thursday at the theater in the former Mayo High School building in Old Louisville. When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with a Pakistani rug importer about fair trade rugs. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Studio 619 brings you news about local arts happenings ahead of time so you can experience the art or performance yourself. And it's not community calendar style. They're interviews or feature story formats with more information to explore on our website. It's just one of the reasons local shows like Studio 619 are important to a public radio station. Shows like Studio 619 are worth your financial support during our spring membership drive. It takes just one call or one visit to our website to renew your membership or become a new member today. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. It takes a village is a well-worn phrase, but in the world of Oriental rug making, it's the literal truth. Yusuf Chaman, a Pakistani rug importer in the U.S., saw people in his homeland struggling to earn a living wage making and selling rugs, and he decided to step in and help. Robin Fisher spoke with Chaman about the rug making culture in Pakistan, fair wages, and how the organization 10,000 Villages is helping to improve the lives of the rug makers.
Let's go ahead and start by asking, what is 10,000 Villages?
Well, 10,000 Villages is a job creation program that is designed to create opportunities for artisans in developing countries, especially the artisans who otherwise may not have any opportunity to earn a fair and livable wage.
Tell me how Jax's Oriental Rugs sort of fits in with the 10,000 Villages.
Jax's is also a job creation program that was started many years ago by 10 families and now has grown into almost 850 families with the idea that people in their villages, in their communities, should be able to earn a fair living wage that would provide education for their children, that would provide three meals a day, and good living conditions for families so they don't have to migrate to cities or leave their home community. So it is designed to create jobs on an equal base for both men and women.
I was wondering if you could tell us, you keep mentioning a fair living wage, mm-hmm. and you know, all of my life, I feel like I have seen these rugs around, but I've just recently sort of become aware of the whole process of the rug making and about the fair wage. And what should we know about that?
Well, I think it's very important that the beautiful rug that you see anywhere on the floor and in the showroom, we all know that they they have a history of lasting very long. And but the main issue is some artisans who can make these rugs that could easily last 100 to 200 years. In the end, do they receive a fair income for it so they can continue to practice this art form? Not very many things you can find today that you can use, you can live on, you can sleep on, you can walk on, and yet the product would last for 200 years. And whereas these rugs are one of a kind because every single rug, the artisan tried to create their own idea. And so in that process, it's very important that the artisan who makes these rugs also have a living wage. And that would mean, again, the three meals a day education for their children and equal opportunity for both men and women so people don't have to leave their home communities from villages and migrate to cities and look for something new job.
One thing that struck me when I was doing research for our interview today was how many people there are involved in making one rug. In my mind, I just had the one rug maker sitting there weaving the rug, but it's everyone from the shepherd to the person washing the rug.
Mm-hmm. Well, it takes from the beginning to the end, it's a good 15 people for a 9x12 rug before it's totally completed. And in some cases, let's say if you take the example of a 9x12 hand-spun wool natural dye rug, the first 6 to 8 months, somebody needs to attain 245 pounds of wool and then spin that wool by hand. That means you need about roughly 46 sheep to produce that much wool in a year. And then you need raw materials like natural dyes to collect enough. And you have to factor in that you know that the weather conditions were such that you need this X amount of quantity for that particular dye or that particular color. And so once you prepare your material, spinning the wool with a spindle for 6 months, and then you collect enough dyes that could take about 2 to 3 months before the wool is ready, then you actually start making your rug. So this is just the initial stage. And in some of the other rugs, the knot count is such high, like 500 to and 800 knots per square inch, that the rug easily takes about a 1 year, 2 months before it's fully completed between designing, dyeing, washing, finishing, everything. So in a person's lifetime, you're talking no more than 15, 16 rugs being done in a 9x12 size if they were to just focus on rug making.
Are there villages whose main occupation is rug making?
There would be a large number of people in the villages of Pakistan that do know how to make rugs. And obviously there are certain villages are more rug village than the others. But throughout the country, there are different tribes, there are different communities who have established their designs, their ideas for centuries. We're talking more than 10 centuries to 2,000 years. I mean, sense of the history, it goes pretty long. And that is another reason that people do not have the desire to walk away from this long history that they have with the art form and source of income or their lifestyle. It is not just about income. It is about their culture.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Yusuf Chaman, director of the Oriental Rug Program for the fair trade organization 10,000 Villages. Chaman and his rugs will be in Louisville Wednesday through Saturday for lectures and showings at Just Creations on Frankfort Avenue. Visit our website for more information, wfpl.org. That's all for today's Studio 619, but there's still time for you to become a member of WFPL this hour. It's our spring membership drive, and we're still waiting to hear from you. Your support is the lifeblood of Louisville Public Media. Join us now and help keep locally produced shows like Studio 619 strong.